an impartial glance at the ancient magistracy. A very happy personage in the year of grace 1482 was the noble gentleman Robert d'Estouteville, Chevalier, Sieur de Bagne, Baron d'Ivry and Saint Adrien La Marche, counselor and chamberlain to the king, and guard of the provostship of Paris. It was already nearly 17 years since he had received from the king, on November 7, 1465, the commoner, asterisk that fine charge of the provostship of Paris, which was reputed rather a seigneury than an office. Tilde dignitas tilde, says Joannes Limnius, tilde quo cum non exequipotestate politium concernant, at prerogativus multis et juribus conjuncta est tilde. A marvelous thing in 82 was a gentleman bearing the king's commission, and whose letters of institution ran back to the epoch of the marriage of the natural daughter of Louis Xi, with Monsieur the Bastard of Bourbon. Asterisk this comet against which Pope Calixtus, uncle of Borgia, ordered public prayers, is the same which reappeared in 1835. The same day on which Robert d'Estouteville took the place of Jacques de Villiers in the provostship of Paris, Master Jehan David replaced Messer Elliot de Thoretz in the first presidency of the Court of Parliament. Jehan Jovenel Desersens supplanted Pierre de Morvilliers in the office of Chancellor of France. Renault de Dormans ousted Pierre Pi from the charge of Master of Requests in Ordinary of the King's Household. Now, upon how many heads had the presidency, the chancellorship, the mastership passed since Robert d'Estouteville had held the provostship of Paris? It had been granted to him for safekeeping, as the letter's patent said, and certainly he kept it well. He had clung to it, he had incorporated himself with it, he had so identified himself with it, that he had escaped that fury for change which possessed Louis Xi. A tormenting and industrious king, whose policy it was to maintain the elasticity of his power by frequent appointments and revocations. More than this, the brave chevalier had obtained the reversion of the office for his son, and for 2 years already, the name of the nobleman Jacques d'Estouteville, equerry, had figured beside his at the head of the register of the salary list of the provostship of Paris. A rare and notable favor indeed. It is true that Robert d'Estouteville was a good soldier, that he had loyally raised his pennon against the League of Public Good, and that he had presented to the Queen a very marvelous stag and confectionery on the day of her entrance to Paris in 14. Moreover, he possessed the good friendship of Messer Tristan Lhermitte, provost of the marshals of the King's Household. Hence a very sweet and pleasant existence was that of Messer Robert. In the first place, very good wages, to which were attached, and from which hung, like extra bunches of grapes on his vine, the revenues of the civil and criminal registries of the provostship, plus the civil and criminal revenues of the tribunals of Embas of the Chatelet, without reckoning some little toll from the bridges of Mans and of Corbeil, and the profits on the craft of shagreen makers of Paris, on the corders of firewood and the measurers of salt. Add to this the pleasure of displaying himself in rides about the city, and of making his fine military costume, which you may still admire sculptured on his tomb in the Abbey of Valmont in Normandy, and his morion, all embossed at Montlhéry, stand out a contrast against the party-colored red and tawny robes of the aldermen and police. And then, was it nothing to wield absolute supremacy over the sergeants of the police, the porter and watch of the Chatelet, the two auditors of the Chatelet, tilde auditors castellet tilde, the 16 commissioners of the 16 quarters, the jailer of the Chatelet, the 4 enfoffed sergeants, the 120 mounted sergeants, with maces, the chevalier of the watch with his watch, his sub-watch, his counter-watch and his rear-watch? Was it nothing to exercise high and low justice, the right to interrogate, to hang and to draw, without reckoning petty jurisdiction in the first resort, tilde in prima instantia tilde, as the charters say, on that Visconti of Paris, so nobly appanaged with 7 noble bailiwicks? Can anything sweeter be imagined than rendering judgments and decisions, as Messer Robert d'Estouteville daily did in the Grand Chatelet, under the large and flattened arches of Philip Augustus, and going, as he was wont to do every evening, to that charming house situated in the Rue Galilee, in the enclosure of the royal palace, which he held in right of his wife, Madame Ambrose de Lore, to repose after the fatigue of having sent some poor wretch to pass the night in that little cell of the Rue de Scorcherie, which the provosts and aldermen of Paris used to make their prison, the same being 11 feet long, 7 feet and 4 inches wide, and 11 feet high? Question mark quote asterisk asterisk comps du domaine, 1383. And not only had Messer Robert d'Estouteville his special court as provost and vicomte of Paris, but in addition he had a share, both for eye and tooth, in the grand court of the king. There was no head in the least elevated which had not passed through his hands before it came to the headsman. It was he who went to see M. de Nemours at the Bastille Saint Antoine, in order to conduct him to the Halles, and to conduct to the grieve M. de Saint Paul, who clamored and resisted, to the great joy of the provost, who did not love Monsieur the Constable. Here, assuredly, is more than sufficient to render a life happy and illustrious, and to deserve someday a notable page in that interesting history of the provosts of Paris, where one learns that Outer de Villeneuve had a house in the Rue des Boucheries, that Guillaume de Hengist purchased the great and the little Savoy, that Guillaume Thibist gave the nuns of Saint Genevieve his houses in the Rue Clopin, that Hugues Aubriot lived in the Hotel du Port Epic, and other domestic facts. Nevertheless, with so many reasons for taking life patiently and joyously, Messer Robert d'Estouteville woke up on the morning of the 7th of January, 1482, in a very surly and peevish mood. Whence came this ill temper? He could not have told himself. Was it because the sky was gray, or was the buckle of his old belt of Montlhéry badly fastened, so that it confined his provostal portliness too closely, had he beheld ribald fellows, marching in bands of four, beneath his window, and setting him at defiance, in doublets but no shirts, hats without crowns, with wallet and bottle at their side? Was it a vague presentiment of the 370 livres, 16 sous, 8 farthings, which the future King Charles Viat was to cut off from the provostship in the following year? The reader can take his choice. We, for our part, are much inclined to believe that he was in a bad humor, simply because he was in a bad humor. Moreover, it was the day after a festival, a tiresome day for everyone, and above all for the magistrate who is charged with sweeping away all the filth, properly and figuratively speaking, which a festival day produces in Paris. And then he had to hold a sitting at the Grand Chatelet. Now, we have noticed that judges in general so arrange matters, that their day of audience shall also be their day of bad humor, so that they may always have someone upon whom to vent it conveniently, in the name of the king, law, and justice. However, the audience had begun without him. His lieutenants, civil, criminal, and private, were doing his work according to usage. And from 8 o'clock in the morning, some scores of bourgeois and tilde bourgeoises tilde, heaped and crowded into an obscure corner of the audience chamber of Embas du Chatelet, between a stout oaken barrier and the wall, had been gazing blissfully at the varied and cheerful spectacle of civil and criminal justice dispensed by Master Florian Barbedian, auditor of the Chatelet, lieutenant of Monsieur the Provost, in a somewhat confused and utterly haphazard manner. The hall was small, low, vaulted. A table studded with fleurs de lis stood at one end, with a large armchair of carved oak, which belonged to the provost and was empty, and a stool on the left for the auditor, Master Florian. Below sat the clerk of the court, scribbling, opposite was the populace, and in front of the door, and in front of the table, were many sergeants of the provostship in sleeveless jackets of violet camlet, with white crosses. Two sergeants of the parloir aux bourgeois, clothed in their jackets of tousand, half red, half blue, were posted as sentinels before a low, closed door, which was visible at the extremity of the hall, behind the table. A single pointed window, narrowly encased in the thick wall, illuminated with a pale ray of January sun two grotesque figures, the capricious demon of stone carved as a tailpiece in the keystone of the vaulted ceiling, and the judge seated at the end of the hall on the fleurs-de-lis. Imagine, in fact, at the provost's table, leaning upon his elbows between two bundles of documents of cases, with his foot on the train of his robe of plain brown cloth, his face buried in his hood of white lamb's skin, of which his brow seemed to be of a piece, red, crabbed, winking, bearing majestically the load of fat on his cheeks which met under his chin, Master Florian Barbedian, auditor of the Chatelet. Now, the auditor was deaf. A slight defect in an auditor. Master Florian delivered judgment, nonetheless, without appeal and very suitably. It is certainly quite sufficient for a judge to have the dot air of listening, and the venerable auditor fulfilled this condition, the sole one in justice, all the better, because his attention could not be distracted by any noise. Moreover, he had in the audience a pitiless censor of his deeds and gestures, in the person of our friend Gianfrallo du Maulin, that little student of yesterday, that stroller, whom one was sure of encountering all over Paris, anywhere except before the rostrums of the professors. "Stay," he said in a low tone to his companion, Robin Pauspain, who was grinning at his side, while he was making his comments on the scenes which were being unfolded before his eyes, "yonder is Jehanton du Busson, the beautiful daughter of the lazy dog at the March Neuf. Upon my soul, he is condemning her, the old rascal, he has no more eyes than ears. 15 sous, 4 farthings, Parisian, for having worn 2 rosaries. 'Tis somewhat dear. Tilde Lex Dury Carminis tilde. Who's that? Robin Chief de Ville, hauberkmaker. For having been passed and received master of the said trade. That's his entrance money. He, 2 gentlemen among these knaves. Aiglet de Soignes, Hutton de Mailly 2 equerries, tilde corpus christi tilde. Ah, they have been playing at dice. When shall I see our rector here? 100 livres Parisian, fine to the king. That Barbedian strikes like a deaf man, as he is. I'll be my brother the archdeacon, if that keeps me from gaming. Gaming by day, gaming by night, living at play, dying at play, and gaming away my soul after my shirt. Holy Virgin, what damsels! One after the other my lambs. Ambrose Lecaire, Isabella Paynette, Bearer Guerinon. I know them all, by heavens. A fine, a fine. That's what will teach you to wear gilded girdles, 10 sous per isis, you coquettes. Oh, the old snout of a judge, deaf and imbecile. Oh, Florian the dolt. Oh, Barbedian the blockhead. There he is at the table. He's eating the plaintiff, he's eating the suits, he eats, he chews, he crams, he fills himself. Fines, lost goods, taxes, expenses, loyal charges, salaries, damages, and interests, Gehenna, prison, and jail, and fetters with expenses, are Christmas spice cake and marchpans of St. John to him. Look at him, the pig, come. Good. Another amorous woman. Thibaud la Thibaud, neither more nor less. For having come from the Rue Glatigny. What fellow is this? Geoffroy Mabon, gendarme bearing the crossbow. He has cursed the name of the father. A fine for La Thibaud. A fine for Geoffroy. A fine for them both. The deaf old fool, he must have mixed up the two cases. 10 to 1, that he makes the wench pay for the oath, and the gendarme for the amour. Attention, Robin Pauspain. What are they going to bring in? Here are many sergeants. By Jupiter, all the bloodhounds of the pack are there. It must be the great beast of the hunt, a wild boar. And 'tis one, Robin, 'tis one. And a fine one too. Tilde H-E-R-C-L-E tilde, 'tis our prince of yesterday, our pope of the fools, our Bellinger, our one-eyed man, our hunchback, our grimace. 'Tis Quasimodo. It was he indeed. It was Quasimodo, bound, encircled, roped, pinioned, and under good guard. The squad of policemen who surrounded him was assisted by the chevalier of the watch in person, wearing the arms of France embroidered on his breast, and the arms of the city on his back. There was nothing, however, about Quasimodo, except his deformity, which could justify the display of halberds and arquebuses. He was gloomy, silent, and tranquil. Only now and then did his single eye cast a sly and wrathful glance upon the bonds with which he was loaded. He cast the same glance about him, but it was so dull and sleepy that the women only pointed him out to each other in derision. Meanwhile, Master Florian, the auditor, turned over attentively the document and the complaint entered against Quasimodo, which the clerk handed him, and, having thus glanced at it, appeared to reflect for a moment. Thanks to this precaution, which he always was careful to take at the moment when on the point of beginning an examination, he knew beforehand the names, titles, and misdeeds of the accused, made cut and dried responses to questions foreseen, and succeeded in extricating himself from all the windings of the interrogation without allowing his deafness to be too apparent. The written charges were to him what the dog is to the blind man. If his deafness did happen to betray him here and there, by some incoherent apostrophe or some unintelligible question, it passed for profundity with some, and for imbecility with others. In neither case, did the honor of the magistracy sustain any injury, for it is far better that a judge should be reputed imbecile or profound than deaf. Hence he took great care to conceal his deafness from the eyes of all, and he generally succeeded so well that he had reached the point of deluding himself, which is, by the way, easier than is supposed. All hunchbacks walk with their heads held high, all stutterers harangue, all deaf people speak low. As for him, he believed, at the most, that his ear was a little refractory. It was the sole concession which he made on this point to public opinion, in his moments of frankness and examination of his conscience. Having, then, thoroughly ruminated Quasimodo's affair, he threw back his head and half-closed his eyes, for the sake of more majesty and impartiality, so that, at that moment, he was both deaf and blind. A double condition, without which no judge is perfect. It was in this magisterial attitude that he began the examination. Your name? Now this was a case which had not been provided for by law, where a deaf man should be obliged to question a deaf man. Quasimodo, whom nothing warned that a question had been addressed to him, continued to stare intently at the judge, and made no reply. The judge, being deaf, and being in no way warned of the deafness of the accused, thought that the latter had answered, as all accused do in general, and therefore he pursued, with his mechanical and stupid self-possession, very well. And your age? Again Quasimodo made no reply to this question. The judge supposed that it had been replied to, and continued, now, your profession? Still the same silence. The spectators had begun, meanwhile, to whisper together, and to exchange glances. That will do, went on the imperturbable auditor, when he supposed that the accused had finished his third reply. You are accused before us, tilde primo tilde, of nocturnal disturbance, tilde secundo tilde, of a dishonorable act of violence upon the person of a foolish woman, tilde in prejudicium meretricis, tertio tilde, of rebellion and disloyalty towards the archers of the police of our lord, the king. Explain yourself upon all these points. Clerk, have you written down what the prisoner has said thus far? At this unlucky question, a burst of laughter rose from the clerk's table caught by the audience, so violent, so wild, so contagious, so universal, that the two deaf men were forced to perceive it. Quasimodo turned round, shrugging his hump with disdain, while Master Florian, equally astonished, and supposing that the laughter of the spectators had been provoked by some irreverent reply from the accused, rendered visible to him by that shrug of the shoulders, apostrophized him indignantly, "You have uttered a reply, knave, which deserves the halter. Do you know to whom you are speaking?" This sally was not fitted to arrest the explosion of general merriment. It struck all as so whimsical, and so ridiculous, that the wild laughter even attacked the sergeants of the parloy Oxbourgeois, a sort of pikemen, whose stupidity was part of their uniform. Quasimodo alone preserved his seriousness, for the good reason that he understood nothing of what was going on around him. The judge, more and more irritated, thought it his duty to continue in the same tone, hoping thereby to strike the accused with a terror which should react upon the audience, and bring it back to respect. So this is as much as to say, perverse and thieving knave that you permit yourself to be lacking in respect towards the auditor of the chatelet, to the magistrate committed to the popular police of Paris, charged with searching out crimes, delinquencies, and evil conduct, with controlling all trades, and interdicting monopoly, with maintaining the pavements, with debarring the hucksters of chickens, poultry, and waterfowl, of superintending the measuring of faggots and other sorts of wood, of purging the city of mud, and the air of contagious maladies, in a word, with attending continually to public affairs, without wages or hope of salary. Do you know that I am called Florian Barbedian, actual lieutenant to Monsieur the Provost, and, moreover, commissioner, inquisitor, controller, and examiner, with equal power in provostship, bailiwick, preservation, and inferior court of judicature? There is no reason why a deaf man talking to a deaf man should stop. God knows where and when Master Florian would have landed, when thus launched at full speed and lofty eloquence, if the low door at the extreme end of the room had not suddenly opened, and given entrance to the provost in person. At his entrance Master Florian did not stop short, but, making a half turn on his heels, and aiming at the provost the harangue with which he had been withering Quasimodo a moment before, "Monseigneur," said he, "I demand such penalty as you shall deem fitting against the prisoner here present, for grave and aggravated offense against the court." And he seated himself, utterly breathless, wiping away the great drops of sweat which fell from his brow and drenched, like tears, the parchments spread out before him. Messer Robert d'Estouteville frowned, and made a gesture, so imperious and significant to Quasimodo, that the deaf man in some measure understood it. The provost addressed him with severity, "What have you done, that you have been brought hither, knave?" The poor fellow, supposing that the provost was asking his name, broke the silence which he habitually preserved, and replied, in a harsh and guttural voice, "Quasimodo." The reply matched the question so little, that the wild laugh began to circulate once more, and Messer Robert exclaimed, red with wrath, "Are you mocking me also, you errant knave?" "Bellringer of Notre Dame," replied Quasimodo, supposing that what was required of him was to explain to the judge who he was. "Bellringer," interpolated the provost, who had waked up early enough to be in a sufficiently bad temper, as we have said, not to require to have his fury inflamed by such strange responses. "Bellringer, I'll play you a chime of rods on your back through the squares of Paris. Do you hear, knave? If it is my age that you wish to know," said Quasimodo, "I think that I shall be 20 at St. Martin's Day." This was too much. The provost could no longer restrain himself. "Ah, you are scoffing at the provostship, wretch. Messieurs the sergeants of the mace, you will take me this knave to the pillory of the grieve, you will flog him, and turn him for an hour. He shall pay me for it, tilde t-d-i-e-u tilde. And I order that the present judgment shall be cried, with the assistance of 4 sworn trumpeters, in the 7 castellanies of the Viscomte of Paris." The clerk set to work incontinently, to draw up the account of the sentence. "Tilde venter dieu tilde, 'tis well adjudged," cried the little scholar, Jehan Frollo du Maulin, from his corner. The provost turned, and fixed his flashing eyes once more on Quasimodo. "I believe the knave said tilde venter dieu tilde clerk, add 12 deniers Parisian for the oath, and let the vestry of St. Eustache have the half of it. I have a particular devotion for St. Eustache." In a few minutes the sentence was drawn up. Its tenor was simple and brief. The customs of the provostship and the Visconti had not yet been worked over by President Thibaut Bailet, and by Roger Barme, the king's advocate. They had not been obstructed, at that time, by that lofty hedge of quibbles and procedures, which the two jurisconsults planted there at the beginning of the 16th century. All was clear, expeditious, explicit. One went straight to the point then, and at the end of every path there was immediately visible, without thickets and without turnings, the wheel, the gibbet, or the pillory. One at least knew whither one was going. The clerk presented the sentence to the provost, who affixed his seal to it, and departed to pursue his round of the audience hall, in a frame of mind which seemed destined to fill all the jails in Paris that day. Jehan Frollo and Robin Pouspain laughed in their sleeves. Quasimodo gazed on the whole with an indifferent and astonished air. However, at the moment when Master Florian Barbedian was reading the sentence in his turn, before signing it, the clerk felt himself moved with pity for the poor wretch of a prisoner, and, in the hope of obtaining some mitigation of the penalty, he approached as near the auditor's ear as possible, and said, pointing to Quasimodo, "That man is deaf." He hoped that this community of infirmity would awaken Master Florian's interest in behalf of the condemned man. But, in the first place, we have already observed that Master Florian did not care to have his deafness noticed. In the next place, he was so hard of hearing that he did not catch a single word of what the clerk said to him. Nevertheless, he wished to have the appearance of hearing, and replied, "Ah, ah, that is different. I did not know that. An hour more of the pillory, in that case." And he signed the sentence thus modified. "'Tis well done," said Robin Pouspain, who cherished a grudge against Quasimodo. "That will teach him to handle people roughly. The rat hole." The reader must permit us to take him back to the place de grief, which we quitted yesterday with Gringer, in order to follow La Esmeralda. It is 10 o'clock in the morning. Everything is indicative of the day after a festival. The pavement is covered with rubbish, ribbons, rags, feathers from tufts of plumes, drops of wax from the torches, crumbs of the public feast. A goodly number of bourgeois are sauntering, as we say, here and there, turning over with their feet the extinct brands of the bonfire, going into raptures in front of the pillar house, over the memory of the fine hangings of the day before, and today staring at the nails that secured them a last pleasure. The vendors of cider and beer are rolling their barrels among the groups. Some busy passers-by come and go. The merchants converse and call to each other from the thresholds of their shops. The festival, the ambassadors, Coppenole, the Pope of the Fools, are in all mouths. They vie with each other, each trying to criticize it best and laugh the most. And, meanwhile, four mounted sergeants, who have just posted themselves at the four sides of the pillory, have already concentrated around themselves a goodly proportion of the populace scattered on the place, who condemn themselves to immobility and fatigue in the hope of a small execution. If the reader, after having contemplated this lively and noisy scene which is being enacted in all parts of the place, will now transfer his gaze towards that ancient demi-Gothic, demi-Romanesque house of the Tour Roland, which forms the corner on the quay to the west, he will observe, at the angle of the facade, a large public breviary, with rich illuminations, protected from the rain by a little penthouse, and from thieves by a small grating, which, however, permits of the leaves being turned. Beside this breviary is a narrow, arched window, closed by two iron bars in the form of a cross, and looking on the square, the only opening which admits a small quantity of light and air to a little cell without a door, constructed on the ground floor, in the thickness of the walls of the old house, and filled with a peace all the more profound, with a silence all the more gloomy, because a public place, the most populous and most noisy in Paris, swarms and shrieks around it. This little cell had been celebrated in Paris for nearly 3 centuries, ever since Madame Roland de la Tour Roland, in mourning for her father who died in the Crusades, had caused it to be hollowed out in the wall of her own house, in order to immure herself there forever, keeping of all her palace only his lodging, whose door was walled up, and whose window stood open, winter and summer, giving all the rest to the poor and to God. The afflicted damsel had, in fact, waited 20 years for death in this premature tomb, praying night and day for the soul of her father, sleeping in ashes, without even a stone for a pillow, clothed in a black sack, and subsisting on the bread and water which the compassion of the passers-by led them to deposit on the ledge of her window, thus receiving charity after having bestowed it. At her death, at the moment when she was passing to the other sepulchre, she had bequeathed this one in perpetuity to afflicted women, mothers, widows, or maidens, who should wish to pray much for others or for themselves, and who should desire to enter themselves alive in a great grief or a great penance. The poor of her day had made her a fine funeral, with tears and benedictions, but, to their great regret, the pious maid had not been canonized, for lack of influence. Those among them who were a little inclined to impiety had hoped that the matter might be accomplished in paradise more easily than at Rome, and had frankly besought God, instead of the Pope, in behalf of the deceased. The majority had contented themselves with holding the memory of Roland sacred, and converting her rags into relics. The city, on its side, had founded in honor of the damosel, a public breviary, which had been fastened near the window of the cell, in order that passers-by might halt there from time to time, were it only to pray, that prayer might remind them of alms, and that the poor recklesses, heiresses of Madame Roland's vault, might not die outright of hunger and forgetfulness. Moreover, this sort of tomb was not so very rare a thing in the cities of the Middle Ages. One often encountered in the most frequented street, in the most crowded and noisy market, in the very middle, under the feet of the horses, under the wheels of the carts, as it were, a cellar, a well, a tiny walled and grated cabin, at the bottom of which a human being prayed night and day, voluntarily devoted to some eternal lamentation, to some great expiation. And all the reflections which that strange spectacle would awaken in us today, that horrible cell, a sort of intermediary link between the house and the tomb, the cemetery and the city, that living being cut off from the human community, and thenceforth reckoned among the dead, that lamp consuming its last drop of oil in the darkness, that remnant of life flickering in the grave, that breath, that voice, that eternal prayer in a box of stone, that face forever turned towards the other world, that eye already illuminated with another sun, that ear pressed to the walls of a tomb, that soul a prisoner in that body a prisoner in that dungeon cell, and beneath that double envelope of flesh and granite, the murmur of that soul in pain, nothing of all this was perceived by the crowd. The piety of that age, not very subtle nor much given to reasoning, did not see so many facets in an act of religion. It took the thing in the block, honored, venerated, hallowed the sacrifice at need, but did not analyze the sufferings, and felt but moderate pity for them. It brought some pittance to the miserable penitent from time to time, looked through the hole to see whether he were still living, forgot his name, hardly knew how many years ago he had begun to die, and to the stranger, who questioned them about the living skeleton who was perishing in that cellar, the neighbors replied simply, "It is the recluse." Everything was then viewed without metaphysics, without exaggeration, without magnifying glass, with the naked eye. The microscope had not yet been invented, either for things of matter, or for things of the mind. Moreover, although people were but little surprised by it, the examples of this sort of claustration in the hearts of cities were in truth frequent, as we have just said. There were in Paris a considerable number of these cells, for praying to God and doing penance, they were nearly all occupied. It is true that the clergy did not like to have them empty, since that implied lukewarmness in believers, and that lepers were put into them when there were no penitents on hand. Besides the cell on the Grève, there was one at Montfaucon, one at the Charnier des Innocents, another I hardly know where, at the Clichon House, I think. Others still at many spots, where traces of them are found in traditions, in default of memorials. The university had also its own. On Mount St. Genevieve, a sort of job of the Middle Ages, for the space of 30 years, chanted the seven penitential psalms on the dunghill at the bottom of a cistern, beginning anew when he had finished, singing loudest at night, tilde magna vos per umbras tilde, and today, the antiquary fancies, that he hears his voice as he enters the Rue du Puits qui Parle, the street of the speaking well. To confine ourselves to the cell in the Tour Roland, we must say, that it had never lacked recklesses. After the death of Madame Roland, it had stood vacant for a year or two, though rarely. Many women had come thither to mourn, until their death, for relatives, lovers, faults. Parisian malice, which thrusts its finger into everything, even into things which concern it the least, affirmed that it had beheld but few widows there. In accordance with the fashion of the epoch, a Latin inscription on the wall indicated to the learned passer-by the pious purpose of this cell. The custom was retained until the middle of the 16th century of explaining an edifice by a brief device inscribed above the door. Thus, one still reads in France, above the wicket of the prison in the seigneurial mansion of Tourville, tilde Siletto et spera tilde. In Ireland, beneath the armorial bearings which surmount the grand door to Fortescue Castle, tilde Forte Scutum, Salus Ducum tilde. In England, over the principal entrance to the hospitable mansion of the Earl's Coper, tilde tuum est tilde. At that time every edifice was a thought. As there was no door to the walled cell of the Tour Roland, these two words had been carved in large Roman capitals over the window, tu, ora. And this caused the people, whose good sense does not perceive so much refinement in things, and likes to translate underscore Ludovico Magno underscore by Port St. Denis, to give to this dark, gloomy, damp cavity the name of the rat hole. An explanation less sublime, perhaps, than the other, but, on the other hand, more picturesque,